I'm Darren Levy, and this is Citywide, airing every Tuesday evening from 7:30 to 8 p.m. right here on WNYU 89.1 FM New York and WNYU.org, New York University Radio. Citywide features insight from some of New York's most innovative artists. Today we are talking with Geraldine Hughes. Geraldine wrote and stars in her one-woman play, Belfast Blues. This performance depicts Geraldine's life growing up as a young child. And now, here to talk with us is Geraldine. So thank you very much for being here.
You're very welcome, Darren.
The play describes your life growing up in Belfast, Northern Ireland, during the 70s and 80s. Would you like to give us a brief background of the early 20th century on how Ireland gained its independence from England, but Northern Ireland did not, so that we can better understand the situation in which you grew up?
A history lesson. Oh my goodness, I'm being tested. Well, you know, very briefly, in the early 20s, Michael Collins was one of the men that signed a treaty that basically divided the country of Ireland. There are 32 counties in Ireland, and it was divided into two parts. 26 remained as the Republic of Ireland under Irish government, and six counties in the north remained under British rule. And so that is officially known as Northern Ireland. And it is ruled by the British government, and we have British money, and Southern Ireland has Irish money and Irish government. That's it in a nutshell.
So now could you tell us a little bit more about the play?
Yeah, well, it's called Belfast Blues, and it is a play, thank you for calling it that, even though it's just me playing all 24 characters. But it is a play. It has a beginning, middle, and end. And it is a story, and it is my story. And my story of growing up in Belfast the first 17, 18 years of my life.
Could you tell us what happened historically when you were growing up?
Well, you know, I grew up at a time, this basically was a time in Northern Ireland when it was very troubled. And the conflict was very much a conflict that was going on the streets. There were bombings and riots, and specifically the big thing that happened during my childhood was the hunger strike, which was when 10 Republican prisoners in the Longcash prison went on hunger strike, and because they wanted to be treated as political prisoners. And Margaret Thatcher was Prime Minister at the time. So historically, that was the big event that was sort of affected me, and it's something that I do mention in the play to give an historical background. The notion of the play is not to get up there and, you know, express how awful it was, and, you know, it's not a therapy session, please. But it is, and it is, there are a lot of laughs in it. But it is simply my story, and that happened to be where I was born, and that just happens to be the historical background to this story. But the notion of the play is really about storytelling. And there's a Gaelic tradition called Shanachie, storytelling tradition, that was really the inspiration of how I wanted to tell the story. You know, why doesn't everybody come in? I'm going to talk to you. I'm going to tell the story. I'm going to play the people in the story. I'm going to take you on a journey. And that is the notion of the play.
So that's a big Irish tradition to tell stories.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Way back when, to the old schoolhouses, you know, when the old man with the shillelagh stick would come and tell the kids stories, and that was part of their education. And that is how you know, stories and events are passed along, as they are in many cultures, but especially with the Irish. The Irish really know how to tell a good story. You know, they love to tell stories, and they also love to tell stories, even stories of great tragedy. They'll find a joke in there somewhere, you know, because there's another Gaelic word called craic, C-R-A-I-C, which means fun. And we're always having great crack. So once you learn the meaning of that word, then you understand what I'm saying. But that's another thing in the play. You know, I want people to have great crack, you know, have good fun too.
So how were you able to incorporate humor into your play?
Well, as an Irish person, it sort of comes naturally, but I hope. But I really, you know, I discovered that the way that people dealt with the conflict and how I grew up and the characters on the streets and people I portray are... were just sort of funny people, you know. They just, the sense of humor was also a way to survive, you know. Because if you were really taking everything so seriously and you really pondered on it without having any sort of release, then you'd be a wreck, you know. But you have to have a laugh in life, because if you don't, you'll just be miserable. You know.
Yeah. I know there was one part in the play where you portrayed your mom carrying a bomb.
Right.
Right past a British guard. Was this sort of thing common?
Well, it didn't happen every day. No, I don't imagine. It was something that, you know, and again, you know, that's a funny scene, right? I mean, people laugh. People are like, well, yeah, people laugh. Oh, my God. You know, why am I laughing? Some people don't laugh. But, yeah, I mean, you know, when you grew up in a war, sometimes you have no choice. You know, you're put in situations where you have to. I mean, if someone puts a bomb in your hand and says, you know, walk it across the street, I don't quite know what I would have done. This is simply, you know, how she handled it. And, you know, it's kind of a mad concept, because I can't believe that that's how we grew up, but that's how we grew up, you know. And I suppose that's why I tell the story, because also it's, you know, this sort of cycle of conflict keeps happening all over the world. And you would wonder why we don't learn from our past.
So how did these events influence your life? Like the hunger strike and your mom carrying a bomb across the street.
Well, and also, you know, the wonderful times we had too. I mean, you know, It was a tough childhood, but, you know, we had, everyone, I think, deals with it with such grace in the play. How did it affect me? Well, I think it made me a very strong person. And I think if you survive conflict, whatever that conflict is, and, you know, I think you learn to sort of deal with things in a much more mature and stronger way. And I certainly view my life and every day as very precious.
Did you ever personally want Northern Ireland to gain its independence from England?
Well, I grew up as a Catholic, as a nationalist, in a nationalist home, in a very working class, very poor neighbourhood. And we felt very oppressed as a people. You know, it was very, you know, it was a very, very difficult time growing up. And so when you are brought up and reared and sort of treated as a second-class citizen, obviously you would want that not to continue. So the hope was that, you know, the 32 counties would be together again and it would be a country united, and that absolutely was the want.
Now I'll talk to the listeners for a minute. If you have a story of your own, or if you'd like to make a comment about the play, maybe you've seen Belfast Blues, you can call into the studio. The phone number is 212-998-1818. 212-998-1818. So now, Geraldine,
how close are we to peace between the English and the Irish?
Well, you know, there is a peace agreement that they're trying to solidify at the minute, and we're closer than we've ever been. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think people like Senator George Mitchell and President Bill Clinton, as American politicians and as incredible men, came over and really helped the two sides sit down together and talk and develop some sort of an agreement as a way of moving forward, as a way of working together towards a truly peaceful situation. And it's very, very close. I mean, I'm, you know, I think about the Middle East as well, and you know, that situation. And I hope and pray that they continue to talk. But in terms of Northern Ireland, I'm very, very hopeful. It's changed so much. You know, it's a great, great place. It always was a great place, but, you know.
Is there anything that we should learn from the feuds between the English and the Irish that can help us with the wars of today?
Well, you know, I don't pretend to be out there preaching huge messages, but I do hope that people think after they see the play and about what war does to kids and about what perhaps, you know, we might learn from history. You know, we continue to repeat, right? We continue to go to war and fight. And, you know, and it even comes down to a personal thing too, as a person. I mean, how do you handle conflict with another human being? I mean, it comes down to human condition. You know, I think everyone needs to breathe more. You know, if we all breathed a bit more and listened a bit more, perhaps conflict wouldn't come up so much, or it would be resolved much quicker. You know, I think it's dreadful that wars continue to happen, and I know that they're part of human nature, but perhaps we might look at history a little bit more and learn from it.
Now, personally, I didn't really consider your piece a political piece.
Oh, good.
I know the play before you at 45 Bleecker was Guantanamo, and
yes,
that was basically strictly political.
Right.
Did you ever want to make your piece political?
You know, it's interesting. It is not a political piece, but it does have a political backdrop. You know, one has to inform the audience of the historical context and everything. But no, this isn't what it's about. It's about my story, and it's about my point of view and the simple and honest, truthful experience that I had. I don't pretend to send out huge messages or to tell anybody else's story.
I'm Darren Levy, and you're listening to Citywide on WNYU 89.1 FM New York, and I'm talking with Geraldine Hughes, who wrote and stars in Belfast Blues. How long did it take you to write this piece?
About 8 months, I suppose, from beginning to end. I started in March, around March 2002, and I wrote, which is sort of technically the first act, and I finished that in June, July, and presented it, and thought I was finished. I was like, okay, it's a one act, fine, you know. But I presented it as in a workshop format to people, a few audiences. I worked at Wake Forest University, and I developed it there. Jonathan Chrisman is my designer, and Kim Terrell from Virtual Theatre Project was really the instigator of all of this. She really said, you have to write this play. This is very important. And I developed it at Wake Forest and presented it to the students, which was really fun. I had a great time. And then I presented it in LA, and the reaction was, okay, where's the rest? So I went back to the computer, and I wrote and developed the rest of it. And then I opened in LA in January 2003.
Did you feel forced at all to write that extra bit? Was it hard to go back to the computer, and
it was
since it
really
wasn't really
hard.
Natural?
Yeah, it was really hard. I mean, I knew it was kind of obvious that I needed to, write more, but it was very difficult to write. First of all, it's always difficult to end a play or to end a piece of work, you know. I don't think it's ending it. I think it's abandoning it, you know, eventually. But it was very difficult because the second half of the play really deals with what I consider is the why of the play, right? And so that is, you know, how did I really feel as a 17-year-old, and where am I, and what has this done to me? And so there is a notion that perhaps I should express how I felt about that. And I sort of fought that for a very long time. And Charles Hayde, who was the director of the original production and a very dear friend who I love dearly, he really encouraged me to sort of go there, as it were, and I think it's important that I do, for just for a short while, but because that's really why I'm telling it, right? To how did I really feel about all this? And I'll let you in that for a minute, you know. But that was very difficult because I always just want to write funny stuff. I want to be funny. I don't want to be serious. But I had to go there for a minute. So,
was there a more deeper meaning why you wanted to write this play?
I was always a chronicler of sorts as a child. I never really had mates, you know. I never went out into the street and had a group of mates that I hung out with. You know, I was a bit of a loner, a bit of an oddball, I suppose. But hey, you know, we're all different. And I would study very hard, and I'd just hang out in our flat, and we lived in these projects, and I'd sort of watch the world from the window, you know, and I was a very religious child as well, and, you know, really very serious girl. But I think when I would write these stories, I began to write these stories in my early 20s when I was at college, and then I started to share them with some friends, just as you do, as you talk and you share things. And again, when Kim Terrell came to me in 2002, she said, read me one of your stories. And after I read it and we started developing the play, you know, the 9/11 event happened. And I remember watching it with my husband, and I thought to myself, my God, you know, it's here now. Terrorism, it's here. And you know, the news was talking about now people are going to have to be searched at airports, you're going to have to go through your bags, take your shoes off. But that's how I grew up, you see. So that was the natural thing. You went into shops and you held out your arms and you got wanded and you got your bag searched. That was just natural behavior. But since having been in America, and I didn't have to do that anymore, that wasn't part of my life, but now again it is. And so it was a little strange, and I thought then perhaps it would be important to tell this story because of that as well. And then also because, you know, the war in Iraq was pending then, you see. And I was performing one night in LA, the first day of the war in Iraq, and I was thinking about the kids. The kids in Iraq, and also the kids that were carrying the guns that were sent over, you know, because they're kids too. Mm-hmm. I felt really bad. And there's a line in the play where I say, I talk about the old world, and I talk about the wee quiet streets are now filled with green giants in tanks carrying guns. And I could barely speak those words that night because I thought about this war that was just starting and the kids, and it was terribly tragic. So anyway, so I thought, well, I think there's a certain relevance here, you know.
Now, when you were a child, you had to worry, just looking a certain way, you could be thrown in jail. You know, obviously we're not at that point here in America yet. Or are we? I think that a lot of people in America, you know, they might be taking it for granted that, you know, well, something like that can never happen here. Or, since you actually experienced it, know that it's possible. Are you afraid of it happening again?
Well, I think you're referring to the internment, which was a time when the British Army could come in and take mostly young men or older men, or sometimes women, of course, out of their homes in the middle of the night, put them in jail and never charge them with anything under a certain law that was created. And, you know, you mentioned Guantanamo. Mm-hmm. That was just playing it bleaker. You know, there are internment camps at the minute that, you know, so it... But certainly in America, as American people, and having that still that sense of freedom, because this is an amazing country. I have been here for 15 years, and I love it, and I loved it from the first minute I stepped foot here when I was 13, when I came over. And I think it's an incredible place, but I would never say never, because I think the world is a very different place now. And I think terrorism and horrible things have come to many beautiful countries recently, and it's horrifying. And I just think we should all, you know, let's, you know, take every day as a precious one. I mean, not to be morbid about it, you know, but I mean, it's you know, you asking me about the truth of life today, and that's what it is. You know, it's interesting because I go back to Belfast, and I'm like, it's like, you know, it's so much better now. You know, it's like, oh, this is great. There is no fear, and you don't get searched as heavily as you do here now, which is quite strange, you know.
So, like we said, the play was about your childhood. Was mm-hmm. everything you said in the play true?
Yeah, I mean, there's a little bit of artistic license with words and dialogue and a little bit of the chronology, but yes, pretty much.
I read on 45bleaker.com mm-hmm. that one of the reasons why you wanted to write this play was that you wanted to inspire other kids to tell their life story.
Oh, well, or at least to tell their story, whatever that story. I mean, I love stories. Don't you love hearing a great story? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the best. And you know what's brilliant about doing this play for me is that I try and make a point of coming out after the show and being in the theatre as some people are still leaving, because I think people tend to want to share a story, you know, or their reaction, or, you know, they want to talk. And I think that's brilliant. And but especially younger people. And I encourage students to come and see the play, and I certainly encourage them to contact me, and I would be very willing to do talkbacks and to come in and talk in classes and lead a workshop or two, you know, no problem, because I love working with younger people, and not that I'm old, but, you know. but, yeah, because there's great stories, no matter who you are, where you're from, everybody's got a great story, you know. It doesn't have to be tragic, you know. I mean, not, you know, funny and weird and, you know, insightful and, you know. Write a story, tell a story. It's fabulous. It's amazing what comes up.
You performed this play in many different cities around the world. What was it like to perform the play in England?
It was interesting, you know. I was very nervous about it because I was reminded of old paranoias. They all came up when I went to England, you know. Feeling Irish, feeling not good enough, feeling all that old stuff I grew up with, you know. But I tell you, it was a triumph. One particular evening, I'll tell you a story. Mm-hmm. There's this wonderful husband and wife, this man and woman, Lynn and Mo Rothman, and they're incredible people. And they saw my show in LA, and they said, when it came to London, they were at their home in London, and they asked me if I would do a benefit for Parkinson's, for an operation, for a deep brain stimulation operation that they were helping develop, because Mo Rothman has Parkinson's. Of course, I said, of course, anything, of course I will. So it was my third night of performance in London, and I discover that this is actually not just a benefit for Parkinson's, but this is being called a Royal Gala performance. A member of the royal family is coming. And not only that, all of these people who are coming are very wealthy European and English royalty, basically. You know, I mean, just very fine folk, you know. And I'm thinking, I said, do you understand? This is just my wee story from Belfast. These people aren't going to get this. I really doubted that they would get... I mean, I was a wreck. And a member of the royal family is going to come and listen to this story. Are you crazy? And Lynn and Mo said, no, we're not crazy. They're going to love it. I was like, all right, well, we'll see. So I'm backstage in London and I'm thinking, I am absolutely nuts. Cut a long story short, I began the play. The play's an hour and 20, 25 minutes. And at the end of the play, these people stood on their feet. And I was so overwhelmed, and I talked to Princess Michael afterwards, and I talked to all of these incredibly, you know, sort of royal people, whoever they were, and they were very honest, and they said, you know, we would have no idea how to begin to relate to how you were brought up, but we loved it because it gave us an insight into perhaps what it was like. And they were just thrilled. And I was thrilled that that I could play for these people too. So London was an extremely, you know, challenging and rewarding place. Bet you have some stories.
Oh, I probably have some stories. Mm-hmm. But perhaps another story you could tell us is you played Mary in the movie Children in the Crossfire.
Uh-huh.
And in the play, you explain the audition process and that there were hundreds of other girls who looked just like you and they tried out for the same part. How did it feel to be chosen out of all those girls?
Yeah, well, it was mad because this American film company were looking for 4 kids, 2 boys and 2 girls. And when I was sent for this to go, and I was going to go to this, I had to go to this hotel in the city centre. It was terrifying. I mean, of course, I had no notion of what an audition was or what this was. I thought there was going to be just me and meeting somebody. There were hundreds. They came from all over Ireland. It was pretty amazing. And the fact that I was chosen was just a miracle, you know. I think it was also kismet. I do believe in destiny too. But it was, it was life-changing.
Another thing in the play was that everybody used the word we.
It's true, we say it a lot, we.
Yeah, you were saying it several times.
Right. Well, you know, everything's we. Like, my husband says we all the time, and the crew in the theatre saying we. Have a wee cup of tea, have a wee, go on the wee stage, have your wee rehearsal.
Is there a reason for that?
No, I don't know. It's just something that's just integrated into part of the language.
I was always curious.
We, and lovely, everything's, that's lovely. It's not lovely, she's lovely. It's a lovely wee play, it was a lovely wee film.
That sounds might be a little English coming over there with a lovely, right?
Maybe.
In the play, you portrayed 24 different characters.
Mm-hmm.
And you seamlessly went between each of them. They had dialogues. How were you able to do this? Was this difficult?
You know, I don't know. It just happened. When I was telling this story for the first time, I started to become Eddie and then I became Margaret. They were literally birthed that day, the first time I started to tell the stories on my feet. It just sort of happened, and as it progressed, I realized, okay, this is a play and I'm going to tell the play myself. But in order to do that, and in order to really make it very clear to the audience who everyone is, I will play with gestures and give everyone a certain gesture or a physicality that as soon as you become that, people know who you are. So I don't need to put on wigs and hats and glasses and coats and whatever, you know. No, it's going to be a very... It's almost like a dance, you know. It's become very fluid. And I wanted it to be a very minimal show, a very pure and honest and truthful show, from the words to the way it's acted, to the way it's directed, to the way it's designed.
Yeah, all you really have on stage is a chair and a table, and all you wear is black shirt and pants.
Mm-hmm.
But in the background, there's a very nice slideshow. So what does that add to the play?
The projections that Jonathan Chrisman designed are incredible. Some of the photographs he took, some of them are archival, and he textured them and integrated them into the grey textured set. And basically what they do is enhance the world that I'm talking about, so people have a notion of what it looks like, you know. God, he did just such an incredible job. And they are so subtle that they don't interfere with the performance, and also they're so beautiful that people remember them as an exquisite part of the play. So I think that he just did an incredible job. And the way that Aaron Deo is the guy that calls the show, and there's a certain timing issue with them too, and he calls it beautifully. And, you know, I just think it was very important for me to have visuals, and Jonathan came up with this great idea.
One image that I always remember is that picture of the peace wall.
Yeah.
It was supposed to separate the Protestants from the Catholics,
mm-hmm.
right? But it wasn't very peaceful, was it?
No, it wasn't. They're still there, the walls. I think that's one of the things that I would dream about happening, is those walls would go away, mm-hmm. and that the communities would be open with one another. I mean, it's going to take a very long time for that to happen. You know, you don't just heal from a horrible conflict in 2 seconds. But yeah, the wall was very important. And Jonathan also built sort of a wall on the stage too that signifies that.
So we're going to have to wrap up soon, but before
no,
we do...
Don't go, Darren, don't go.
What is one message that you'd like someone to walk away with after seeing your play?
Well, I think the word hope comes to mind. I want people to be hopeful. Hopeful that, you know, this wee girl got out okay and she was fine. And that out of a horrible situation, no matter what you're born into, where you're born, who you are, who your mommy and daddy are, who your family are, if you have a notion of a dream, if you want to accomplish something, work hard, keep focused, and you'll get there.
All right. Thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome, Darren.
That's it for Citywide. I'm Darren Levy. You can email your comments about today's show to citywide@wnyu.org. Tune in again next week for more Arts Talk right here on WNYU 89.1 FM New York and WNYU.org, New York University Radio. Now stay tuned for acoustic experimental music up next with Michael on Outside.